Today is May 25th, 2018. My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I'm sitting here on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Public Library, quite pleased to finally be sitting with the remarkable Mort Sahl. Mort, how do I even begin to describe the depth and breadth of who you are? You've been around for a good long while. You've seen more than most people see in 10 lifetimes, and you're a beloved and treasured Mill Valley local.
I appointed myself a lifeguard to save America, because between the political lies and the press being bought and the penetration of the intelligence agencies, I took a long chance. I said, if you tell the audience the truth, they will respond. And they did. And I went to the Hungry Eye in 64 years ago for $75 for 1 week. And I told the audience the truth. And that caught on, and I was signed by CBS, and I was eventually at NBC, and I started Woody Allen and Jonathan Winters and George Carlin and Dick Cavett. I created and revealed an appetite for the facts, and it got dangerous and it got brutal. And eventually, I was on the staff of Jim Garrison when he investigated the death of Kennedy and attributed it to the government. And that made some people think I was unpopular, but I was getting closer to the heart of America. And my hope out of coming out of tremendous poverty, you can't imagine Los Angeles. It resulted in changing the face of comedy, and I don't mean that immodestly. I said the American people want to hear it, and they did. The same people that are following this presidency followed Roosevelt. So I believe in this country. I just thought it was a rescue operation. I'm very serious about the business of comedy. The mission-oriented, like a lifeguard. And it worked. It worked to my benefit and to my heartbreak. I mean, I was married 3 times. And every time I thought that was the time. But people want you to be so brave, and then they jump ship. It's a primary thing with me. Plus, my optimism of mine came from my mother. She really thought you could change the world. Well, she thought love could change the world, too. I still believe that. So as much as I believe the political manifesto, I believe in Johnny Mercer's songs, and I believe in Stan Kenton's orchestra. He was as good as my father. I believe in jazz, and it liberated me, even to a point where in my biography, my ex-wife says every time I took her to see that was an ordeal, but that's a lie, meant to hurt me, because she took what I held most dear and tried to puncture it. It's not true. She enjoyed that band, but she knows it's the dearest thing to me, so she misrepresents it. And if the women are in trouble in this country, theoretically they are, according to feminism, but I think it's a lie. I think they don't know how well off they are. Freud said, a woman who claims the inferior position renounces her superiority. Freud was a real Jew. I mean, he really went to where the heart of the problem is. And then the problem professionally was to translate what sounds deadly serious into deadly hilarious. So the audience decided I wasn't kidding. I started it in Wright City, San Francisco, and then they absconded with it to Los Angeles, New York, Boston. I went all around. I hold the attendance record in every club I ever worked in. And everybody predicted doom. You'll be in trouble if you tell the truth. But the truth is the only thing that makes you free. Makes you lonesome, too.
Makes you lonesome. Well, when you're even just talking right now, describing a quick overview of your experiences and your observations, you have your hand over your heart a lot of the time. It seems that you feel the things that you see and the things that you talk about. And I would like to ask you a few questions about your family to understand a little bit more about you, how you came about. So, and then I'd like to travel through time with you and go into a little more detail about the very things that you're talking about. It seems, as you're describing yourself right now, that you are a vanguard of truth in comedy.
I believed everything I saw at the movies. I was a screenwriter, too. You know, I wrote 22 pictures that I know about. But I really believed if you were noble, you were going to win true love and that love would triumph. All those things drove me, all those unreal things. I believe if they could write a romance, I don't think it's too much talent around now, but if they could conceive a romance, they'd have a successful movie. Because women are still looking for it, and they drag the guys to the theater. They're basically in control, but of course, they can't admit to it because of this pop psychology,
Well, let's talk about you just now. Will you tell me a little bit about your family? Where's your family from? Let's go back a couple generations with your grandparents on both your parents' side, and
it's pretty sketchy. You know, I didn't write to Ancestry.com. Mm.
Were you born? Tell me where you're
born. Montreal.
In Montreal, Canada.
Yeah, that's where my mother was from.
And what is your mother's name?
What did she do?
What was your mother's name?
Dorothy.
Dorothy
Schwartz.
Dorothy Schwartz.
Yeah. And I think they were Romanians. And her father owned the city of Montreal. He was a very aspiring guy. And my dad, they came from Lithuania, 9 boys. And they all went into business successfully. He wanted to be a writer. And he wrote.
And where did he come? He came from Lithuania to where? What city?
Stamford, Connecticut.
And what year? Do you know?
Well, no. Mm-hmm.
What year were you born, Mort?
27.
1927.
Yeah. In Montreal. Mm-hmm. Then my dad had a job in Washington and went there. Mm-hmm. And then he moved to Los Angeles. I went out there when I was 7. In utter poverty. Only dreaming. But persistently.
But your family came from wealth in Montreal. I mean, your mother's father, Schwartz, right?
Yeah.
Owned Montreal.
Yeah.
She married your father.
Yes, let me tell you about that.
Okay.
He put an ad in Poetry Magazine, and he said, is there still a woman out there that would like to meet a dreamer? And she answered the ad.
In a poetry magazine?
Yeah, poetry magazine. What was the name of the magazine? And she took the train, who flew, to Los Angeles. They got married in 3 days.
Wow.
And she believed in love her entire life. I don't want you to be alone. I don't want you to be... And, of course, I wound up alone. Even though I went through the motions. You know, I married the girl in Berkeley. And my second wife was a Chinese girl who was the head of the Playboy Bunnies. She trained them at 19 clubs. Her brother was the sheriff in New Orleans. And the assistant to the leader of the House of Representatives, Hale Buggs.
Well, first, let's start with your... Let's back up just a bit. So your father's a dreamer and your mother's a romantic.
Yeah.
I mean, she took a leap of faith going from Montreal to L.A.
Yeah.
To meet a man who defines himself as a dreamer, maybe one of the last ones.
Yeah, very much so.
And so they married within 3 days. And how many siblings do you have?
None.
You're an only child.
Yeah.
The product of a dreamer and a romantic.
And my father was not family oriented. We didn't visit any cousins. We lived in a kind of poverty.
Where did you live in L.A.?
Downtown, Mexican area. Figueroa and Sunset. I went to Belmont High School with Richard Crenna.
Mm-hmm, the actor.
Yeah. And we're both poor kids dreaming about everything. And abject poverty, you know, $25 a month apartment. I used to go up on the roof where I could be alone and dream of whatever I dreamed about. And I went to SC, but I didn't believe any of it. I hung out in nightclubs at night and listened to jazz, which grabbed me early.
You went to USC? Did you graduate there?
Yeah.
What year did you enter and leave?
I went in 47. I graduated in 50.
And what did you study while you were there?
Street traffic engineering and city
street
management.
Traffic engineering?
Yeah, we keep my father happy.
What did?
Obviously, I didn't follow it.
Uh-huh. And so then you were the good boy going to school, but the real you was going to clubs?
Well, this is Roosevelt's GI Bill. I got $65 a month, mm-hmm. And I lived at home, free books, free tuition. And I hung around the clubs all night, listened to bands, just sat in a corner, drank water. And that's when I became enamored of Stan Kenton.
Of who?
Stan Kenton's orchestra.
Stan Kenton.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he was powerful to all his life. And eventually, when I became successful, I hired him. At the Flamingo in Vegas and at the Crescendo, we broke the house record on Sunset Boulevard. So I got a wide acquaintanceship in jazz. And it still is the only thing that moves me dramatically. And it speaks to me.
What does it say?
It's a defiance. This is what we believe. The Kenton Band is, it's like a way of life. It was nobody like him. He changed everything. Very paternal, very commanding. And he'd never say goodnight. He'd say straight ahead. He was really 6'5". And I was starving. He always made sure he fed me.
Because you were one of his dedicated fans, he respected that?
I came down there one night, and the band manager said, would you like to meet him? I said, yeah. And he came over and said, Stan, I was perspiring. I was so scared and everything. And before he said my name, Kenton said, I know this guy. He comes every night. Then I started to bring the girls to see him. And they all rejected it. It's too loud. So I rejected them. I went back alone. And I never was with a girl that really heard it. They had other priorities. I was married a long time, and I'm not a hit and run artist. The girl in Berkeley was studying psychology, and we were married 25 years.
So you married, now how old are you when you were going to hear the music in L.A.?
About 19.
And when did you move to Berkeley?
When I was about 22, she came up here, so I followed her. And she roomed with two other girls, and I slept on a window seat.
So she came to go to UC Berkeley?
Yeah.
Study psychology?
Yeah.
And what's her name? Who is this
Susan
mysterious woman?
Babior, B-A-B-I-O-R.
So you followed Susan to Berkeley where she was studying?
That's right.
And you slept in the window?
On the window seat. And she said to me one day, you have to try this, the comedy. She said, because if you don't, you're going to blame me all your life while you work in some office. And if you succeed, we're going to have a pretty good lifestyle. But I'm not going to stand in the way of it. So I said, where'll I go? She said, go to the Hungry Eye. I said, what if they don't laugh? She said, they'll say it's whimsical comedy.
She sounds like a very interesting woman.
Yeah.
So she saw your potential. Were you, I mean,
yeah, I
was you just, were, what is it that she saw in you that led her to believe that you certainly would be successful?
I don't know. Passion, I guess. And we were really in love when we got married. I broke through, and Dave Brubeck was breaking through at the Black Hawk at Turk and Hyde.
At Turk and what?
Turk and Hyde in the city.
Oh, the Black Hawk, Turk and Hyde.
And then we went to the Monterey Jazz Festival, and she and I got married in Carmel. And I was like 26, and she was like 21, 7 years difference. And she graduated in psychology, and she's still in the East Bay.
She's still in the East Bay. Will you spell her first name?
Susan.
Just plain Susan. I can spell that.
Yes. B-A-B-I-O-R.
B-A-B-I-O-R. So, Susan saw the potential of your wit and your observations and your passion.
And I succeeded at the Hungry Eye. You know, I stayed there for years.
Tell me what your first experience at the Hungry Eye was like. What did you talk about? Do you remember?
I picked up the Chronicle and I went through the news.
So you simply ad-libbed it. You picked up the Chronicle and you looked at the news and you just started talking.
And it wasn't so successful. And she packed a lot of students.
Oh.
The first night. But I thought that was all my own. And I somehow hung on. And finally, Herb Cain got a letter. If you're Mr. San Francisco, why haven't you picked up on this kid? And my letter was from my mother, who lived on Sutter Street. So he did come down, and he did pick up on it. And we were married in his house at Pearson Scott.
Wait, I'm confused. So you're at the Hungry Eye.
Yeah.
And there's a buzz starting about you. You're picking up, is it every night you're picking up the newspaper and making commentary?
Yeah, right out of the paper.
So there's a buzz about you. I mean, how many comedians or whatever you are their act is reading the newspaper. What gave you that idea?
Because I couldn't remember the jokes. I wrote them on the paper. So but I couldn't see the paper out there. So I decided to throw it away and do what occurred to me. And then it began to be quoted. And that's when the political figures began to contact me.
So Herb Cain gets sniff of you. And he says, if you're in San Francisco, how come you don't know about this guy?
Yeah, and he went down there. And then eventually I got to know him and I got married in his house.
So you married Susan at his house.
Yeah.
And you said something about your mother?
Pardon me?
Did you say your mother was living on Sutter?
Yeah.
So your mother had moved from Montreal to be with you in San Francisco?
No, I moved them from L.A. They weren't
oh, in L.A., rather. So yeah. Your parents were both living in L.A., still not making, you know, I know you said you
were... No, just struggling along.
And so you started, you just...
I brought them up, yeah. And
as your success started to build, you had enough money.
She cavelled, and my father wasn't so sure.
Cavelled? What's that? A Yiddish word. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean for the people that are listening?
Well, there's nothing like Yiddish. I don't know how psychiatrists work without it. It's so precise.
What is quelled?
A verb for being overjoyed, really, you know. I suppose some psychiatrists know it. The old ones. The ones who were communists and everything. The new ones are dispensing pills, I guess.
So your mother saw that her unique son is now has his own unique voice, and he's being listened to. What mother could wish for more?
Oh, it went on like that. Eventually, after I knew Kennedy, I knew Johnson. I took my father to the White House. And he liked Johnson. And I said, you're destroying everything I built, you know, but the joke was lost, of course, in that audience.
So you're living in San Francisco and you're at the Hungry Eye and you've got a buzz going about you. You've got an audience building.
Yeah, then I get signed by CBS.
And then how did that happen?
Herb Cain brought in the president of CBS. They brought me to L.A. And they signed Johnny Carson and me. They didn't know what to do with me. So I didn't change. I wouldn't change anything. And they were all cynical. You know, the audience won't understand. It's too intellectual. It's too political. But I know better about the American people. They were longing to be free, to paraphrase Lincoln. And I kept going, and then I got a call from Joe Kennedy, and he said, I understand you're the master of this. You can remove Nixon's third rib, but you won't stab him with a stiletto.
Wait, say that again? He says... Joe Kennedy says what to you?
That you have the skill to remove Nixon's third rib, but you don't use a stiletto. And I'd like you to work for my son, Johnny.
Meaning you used your voice, not any kind of violence.
No, to write the speeches.
Oh, so he wanted you to be the speechwriter for his upcoming...
Yeah, so I did. I met the people around them. Mm-hmm. And at another juncture, I can tell you, which ones he could trust. You know when he made his inauguration speech? You recall he had Robert Frost there.
Mm-hmm.
Frost wrote him a note and he said, beware of vain men in your court, young king.
Mm.
Which he did. And they thought I was clever but unstable because I liked them. But I really like Castro and Che Guevara. They couldn't figure that out. Oh, I already knew Adlai Stevenson and Eugene McCarthy because they all heard the material as it went through those cities.
So you, by now you're on tour. You're going from place to place. You're pollinating the country.
Yeah, and I held the attendance record in every club. So Boston, New York.
You're pollinating the country with your critical analysis.
Skeptical, yeah.
A skeptical analysis. You're challenging.
And then I called Sue and I said, I'm back with a sack full of money and awards and everything. Can you meet me in a 3 o'clock plane? She said, no. I have a class. I'm a person, too. That was the beginning of the schism.
Okay, so you have, your lives are slightly different courses, but you're out there working.
I have the work. That's what I always have.
Were you ever surprised to find yourself suddenly in these various arenas, simply just communicating in the way that you've wanted
to? I knew that subconsciously people agreed with me. And I found a way to phrase it to help them in. And then by that time I was moved to Los Angeles and I knew everybody. I knew Steve McQueen and I knew Paul Newman. These are guys I knew intimately. And William Holden and Sam Peckinpah. And I was forming my own way of thinking. I was living out at the beach and buying sports cars and everything. And she was up here becoming a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved on through a bunch of actresses and everything. And then Hefner introduced me to the Bunny and Chyna.
Chyna, your second wife.
Yeah, second wife. And that went on 25 years.
So your first wife was how many years again, I think you said?
About 3 years.
3 years for your first wife.
And she stayed here. She never wanted to go back to L.A.
So that 3 years with your first wife, and then you met Chyna in what year?
I met her, let's see. I don't remember the year.
Do you remember what you were wearing?
I was working in Chicago with Mr. Kelly's.
That's where the original first Kef's Club was in Chicago.
The big
correct?
Club.
Yeah. Let's just go back a little bit. I hesitate to walk away from Joe Kennedy just yet.
Yeah.
Will you talk a little bit about Joe Kennedy? What kind of person you found him to be, the Kennedys?
Well, he was a fascist. And he believed that Hitler was going to win and said so. And he played cards with William O. Douglas. Do you remember him in the Supreme Court?
Mm-hmm.
Roosevelt Inderman. And he said to him during a poker game, he said, I believe Hitler's going to win. I think Roosevelt's the dictator. And I'm a Catholic and you're an atheist. And he said, I must be crazy to be your friend. Am I crazy? And Douglas said to him, based on the evidence, you're crazy. A great man, Douglas, just like Henry Wallace, a great visionary. Also Gene McCarthy, whom I had the pleasure of knowing intimately, and Stevenson. It was very abundant, even though the Democrats in Mill Valley act like they're serving prison time. They had some great prophets among them. And I got to know them.
Well, so Joe Kennedy, who you describe as a fascist, hires a Jewish kid from California to be a speechwriter for his son.
Because he thought it would be useful. And it was. I did a lot of work for them. For nothing, I might add.
For nothing.
Nothing. Not only nothing, but when he was elected, there's real irony in what you're doing. When he was elected, he never paid me, and I was flying to rallies with the likes of Lauren Bacall and Myrna Loy and helping
bringing your people in.
And writing his speeches. And when he got elected, we had a big party in New York with Paul Newman and Cliff Robertson, the whole Broadway crowd, Gore Vidal, and I emceed it with Stevenson at the Marasco Theater. They never thanked me. They never paid me. They didn't invite me to the inauguration. And although I got along well with the president, they didn't, as I said, they didn't invite me. And then afterward, when I did some jokes about Kennedy, the old man told everybody not to hire me, which is the first time I'd encountered that resistance. And they didn't. He was out to kill me. He was really, you know, unforgiving. So, and came up empty if you're a religious person. They killed all those kids. He didn't do anything. And where was I? I was with Jim Garrison, the DA of New Orleans, looking for the guys that killed him and named them on the air. I named them on the Carson show. I said, the CIA killed the president. And I made a lot of enemies. And I had a few people listening religiously.
Why did you stay with the Kennedys? Were you paying your own airfare and you were bringing in your Hollywood and your acting crowd? This you were doing? Why? What motivated you to stay there if you were basically unsupported?
Well, the old man had asked me to take the job and...
It's not really a job because you're not getting paid.
Yeah, we didn't say anything about the money. I'm not the kind of guy that brings that up anyway. But my manager was saying to me, who was Lawford's manager as well.
Peter Lawford, the actor's manager.
Yeah, he said, well, you're going to be a king, you know, Stevenson, you know, the president and everything. Well, far from a king, but they should have known. Their responsibility was to know that I'm an unbridled spirit. I'm going to report whatever I see. I didn't like any of the crowd around him. Arthur Schlesinger and the National Security Advisor and that tall guy that he made ambassador to India. I didn't like the whole crowd. But he was all right.
Who was all right?
The president.
Yes, John Kennedy.
Yeah, and they removed him when he started to fight with the CIA. So that got me into the other thing with Garrison. I felt it should be told and we'd be vindicated. And Garrison was really brave. And the Oliver Stone movie is a fake. And I think Oliver Stone is a fake, but that's another issue.
Did you read David Talbot's book, The Devil's Chessboard?
Yeah, I know Talbot. He researched a lot of that with me.
Mm-hmm.
Had a stroke, I heard.
Yes, I have interviewed him, as you can hear his
interview. Yeah, he researched a lot of it with me when I was working at the RAS room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's idealized, of course, because Bobby was pretty tough. I remember the joke, too.
What is the joke?
When he appointed Bobby as Attorney General, little brother is watching you. That was his joke. I remember it.
Was that your joke? Or
Yeah. And the liberals didn't want to hear it. So, they wanted to hear it was noble.
You haven't answered my question. I must ask. So you obviously have opportunity to meet remarkable people, the true mockers of an era in your job that's not really a job, your volunteer work. With the Kennedy family.
Yeah.
In the helping of the making of America.
Yeah, make the jokes funny and all that
stuff. But also you're working as a speechwriter. And did you have the ear of the president? Did you have any influence in the way that he...
Oh, yeah. He wanted to appear sharp and anything and everything. But I must say that... That show business crowd around him was only interested in introducing him to starlets.
Oh,
so I wanted to introduce him to the opportunity to change history. A lot of idealism working there, you know, and then...
On your part.
Oh, yeah, I was at the convention. Mrs. Roosevelt said to me, did he give you that book, Profiles in Courage? And yeah, she said to me, did it ever occur to you that he's more profile than courage? She was great. Great. President was lucky to have her.
And we're talking about Roosevelt?
Yeah, Miss Eleanor Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice the feminists never mention her. They mention Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan. She was really something, and so was Roosevelt.
No, some feminists do mention her. I have to challenge you. I took feminism class, and we read about Eleanor Roosevelt. But this was...
And Jean McCarthy was something, and Adlai Stevenson was everything. I knew him well, and he treated him very badly. The Kennedys.
Okay, so the Kennedys. Being in that world... The Kennedy world, you know, there's this sensational, the glamour, the power. I mean, they really are a family that, for as long as can be, have projected this fantastic somehow image that America identifies with. How did you feel about yourself at that time in that world?
Well, you always had a lot of girls because they want to be invited to that stuff.
So
they cultivate you. And I was dating a lot and everything. And then I met the Reagans. Mm-hmm. And Sheena and I went to the Reagan White House.
Your wife, Sheena, now your second wife.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And... But she was a Chinese gambler.
Sheena was a Chinese gambler?
Horses. Yeah. And I don't know if she ever understood what I was doing. But literally, I don't. But what I was doing, whether I was deluding myself or not, I really felt like a lifeguard. I'm going to go save America. I'm going to tell the audience the truth, and they're going to change things. Mm-hmm. That's where I was.
That was your ideal inside. That was.
And then I met Nancy Reagan, which introduced me to the Reagans, and I got along great with her. And I liked it because she looked after her husband. There's something that really appealed to me in that. And by that time, I was divorcing Sheena.
And this is after 25 years.
Yeah.
So let's just organize our time a little. You're with the Kennedy. This is now in the 60s, correct? What years are you with the Kennedy clan in your experiences?
From about 59 to the middle of his first term. Well, I helped him mostly with the election. Mm-hmm. And Sinatra was the intermediary. He signed me to the label. Then I put on an album making fun of Kennedy, which they became furious about.
The Kennedys became furious.
Sinatra became furious
about. Sinatra.
And, but he wasn't politically sophisticated. And he was going, there was a break when... He's supposed to come to Frank's house in Palm Springs, and he went to Crosby's house because the old man said Sinatra's a gangster.
Oh, so John Kennedy goes to Crosby's house because his dad has advised him against hanging out with Sinatra because Sinatra's hanging out with the unsavory types in Vegas.
He likes the gangsters. So I lost on all fronts, and I had a lot of trouble working.
So while you're with the Kennedy clan, are you continuing to do your stand-up routines and your commentary, or have you mostly just gone to television and writing, or what was your life like, apart from the work you did with them?
Well, I was going back to the same clubs and I was going on television, but people were telling me what to say. Oh. And a lot of people were turning me down. And... everything became very timid. I lost the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. He didn't want any of that on there.
He didn't want any what?
Any real political comment about Vietnam. I was still making it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the clubs were not available. And I went from, millions of dollars a year to 19,000 when I could work.
So working with the Kennedys didn't really work out that well for you. Or did it? Would you say that that was what time well spent in your life?
Well, yeah, it was stimulating mentally, and but I was a romantic. I was distracted by the girls and everything.
Romantic is the word you're using? With all those lovely women?
That was always a big part of my life. The promise. True love.
But you're married to Gina.
Well, I thought she'd think I'm heroic. Mm-hmm. But she had a lot of pragmatism in her. And every girl has a father. And when they get married, they want a better version of their father. That's really what they're looking for.
Freud
right?
My goodness.
Man. It's always the Jewish guys that can see through a wall.
It's the Jewish guys that can see through all?
Through the wall. They used to be.
Not the new ones.
Do
you think you have X-ray vision?
Pardon me?
Do you have X-ray vision?
Well, I don't know how smart I am, but I'm smart enough to admire the guys that were smart. Freud's really good, you know. He said, when Adler criticizes him, he said, why is he so mad at you? And Freud said, he can't forgive me for all I did for him. He's a real Jewish guy, you know. When he hits a hard note with a patient, she says, what's the matter with you? Do you want my blood? And he says to her, you're in a menstrual period, aren't you? He gets it right away. And every woman's looking for a better version of her father. And then I learned that the liberals have no courage at all.
Liberals have no courage?
No.
Tell me about that.
They want to go along with the crowd. In other words, it's your fault. If the writers are blacklisted, it's their fault. You know the way the crowd is going. Why don't you go there too? So they were mad at me all the time. They were admiring me. They were mad at me for exposing them as hypocrites. And then in order to supplement my income, I started writing screenplays because I wasn't getting any work. And I met them all, but they were pretty shy of courage. They're afraid they're going to lose their meal ticket.
Who is now?
And people in the business, directors and people at the studios.
Well, this is after McCarthyism, I guess.
It's after that.
Yeah, it's after.
But in other words, a guy like Sam Peckinpah is a real person. A guy like Norman Lear is not a person. He writes stereotyped people, dictatorial women, blood. The Jeffersons are black people who never existed. And Archie Bunker, it's a fraud. He sings. We could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. All those guys voted for Roosevelt, that working class. It's a lie. When he's asked about me, he said, he's too bitter for me. I'm bitter?
Who said that?
Lear.
Norman Lear.
They shot the president in a car. They removed his body illegally. You're not allowed to move a dead body. And Johnson did. And reversed all his policies and killed 58,000 people in Vietnam. Then I have to figure out, how do you make that funny? What's the vulnerability? Yes. I guess it's that people don't really like Johnson. And eventually, and the jokes come to you, you know, sometimes they come to you. For instance, Romney's father was the governor of Michigan, and he was against the war. And Nixon called him up, started yelling at him, you got to come out for the war. So we went to Vietnam. And General Westmoreland showed him everything. And he said, I was wrong. The war is great. Then he came back and he went on the air and meet the press. And he said, the war is really awful. It's the worst thing we ever did. But the generals brainwashed me. And Gene McCarthy just said, a light rinse would have done it. She said, well, there was a joke in there.
Yeah.
There was always something they couldn't ignore. But they did a pretty good job of trying. And I kept going, you know, because once I get a bite, you know, I really...
Did you ever feel like you have a superpower of sorts, a special gift to find the way to expose, to reveal the irony or the hypocrisy?
Well, yeah, but it's more like a dream. It's a dream that everybody's going to hear about the hypocrisy and get mad and change it. And obviously they haven't. They don't have the courage. They're living, most of the women I know are living without being loved. And the men are living and pretending that the money in San Jose is enough rather than being in love with anybody. So it's a country that's deluding itself. And then when you talk to them around here, they keep telling you about Trump. I mean, is there really one guy that could destabilize you?
We'll get to Mill Valley shortly. But before we go to Mill Valley, because that's definitely something I want to talk to you about, I want to ask you, we'll back up a little to when you're talking about your efforts in comedy to be able to reveal what's going on politically, to use your venue, to use your position to share the truth, to make social change. Certainly there are other comedians like Lenny Bruce and George Carlin, people you said that you knew. Did you ever feel that brotherhood or community of people that
saw? No.
How was your experience with, I mean, George Carlin is certainly...
I gave him his first job in Chicago.
Talk about that, will you, a little? I'm a personal fan of George Carlin, so I'd love to hear your...
You notice what he did as he got older. He got a ponytail and black T-shirt and started to act like Lenny Bruce. Went to the colleges and said, the country's run by rich white men playing golf. That's like throwing a bone to natives. That's not what's really wrong.
You said that's like throwing a bone to natives? What did you just say?
He said, that line about white people playing golf is like throwing a bone to a dog.
Oh, okay.
The kids get a chance to rebel against the people that are paying for them to go to Wharton. I mean, it's not truthful. I don't think they all see the truth, but it's not truthful. I gave him a job when he was working in a deli in Chicago, Eli's Delicatessen.
What year is this?
Oh, when I was running at Mr. Kelly's, I worked there for about 30 years on and off in Chicago. I found him, and I put Cabot to work. And I put Woody to work. I brought everybody into the Hungry Eye. Shelley. All the records Shelley sold. I made the first comedy record, and I put him on there. And Nichols and May. All of them. The most talented is Winters.
Jonathan Winters?
Who's a Republican, by the way. He's a Republican.
You think of Jonathan Winters as the most...
Oh, yeah. The most gifted. Freest. Didn't swear, saw through social hypocrisy.
He pushed buttons. I remember talking to him once in Santa Barbara, and he never hesitated to say the most outrageous thing right from the get-go. It's almost like he was...
Yeah, he was really gifted. And the rest of them are... they won't go too far out of line. You got to remember... We went from democracy with Roosevelt to fascism, and nobody said anything. What they talked about is that phony liberation rap and the phony thing of loving Negroes, which they don't. Why don't they say they don't? If they're too scared to say it, why don't they just skip it entirely? But the thing that they love them, and they love their music, and... It's not true. Or that they understand women.
They. When you're talking about they.
The men.
The men.
The men who say, they say these things because they're in vogue, but they don't love them. They don't even understand them.
When you say that, they don't love them, they don't understand them, just break that down a little bit for me. What leads you to make that conclusion?
What
brings you to that conclusion?
Oh, because they do what's politically expedient. They marry people that are secure but have no capacity to love them. You know, to think about nothing but them while they're at the office in San Jose. To think of surprises for them. To look upon making love to them as something more than a chore. The materialism. And the women have gotten tougher because they're afraid the men aren't tough. And they make terrible men. This whole thing about sex changes, men make terrible women because they don't have any insight. I know, I've been married to girls who could really see through walls. You know, but life is nothing without love, and it doesn't come with a sex change operation. My mother always was telling me that. There's got to be someone there who loves you. My mother really believed in it, you know, and my dad was tough. He was tough, you know. Unyielding, and a loner. My mother never got discouraged. You know, we're living in a $25 a month apartment most of the time in Los Angeles. And I used to go to the Central Library because it was free. And if I had 10 cents, I'd go to the movies. And I believed all that, you know. Everybody believed it. I mean, I saw Casablanca the other night. Mm-hmm. You got to have a yearning to believe that. There's nothing believable in the picture. But you want to believe it. And if they made what they call a chick flick now, the women would make the men go to gently hint to them that being a romantic is a real destiny. I mean, Robert De Niro is a good actor, but he's not a romantic.
Who do you admire? Who does embody what you're describing in a true sense?
John Wayne, Gary Cooper, Joel McRae. You know, in the end of Peckinpah's movie, Ride the High Country, he's an older cowboy and he has nothing. And Randall Scott says to him, "What do you want, Steve?" He says, "I want to walk into my own house undiminished." I love William Holden as a friend. I love McQueen because he was alive. He wasn't politically aware, but he was alive. And Ally McGraw's a great name. But there aren't many of them that will go to bat. I mean, all of this. Did you see the Weinstein indictment today?
No, I did not.
$10 million bail. And the lawyer said, "Well, he didn't invent the casting couch, Your Honor." The country's bizarre, but it's not dangerous. It doesn't take any chances. The old movies are all about what I did for love. The ones I wrote were all about love redeeming everybody, and no producer had to put a gun in my head. There was a reward for being a man, and that was that girl at the end of the trail. Did you see The Quiet Man? Did you ever see that? Wayne and Maureen O'Hara?
A long time ago.
When he goes back to Ireland.
Uh-huh.
Those pictures they're truthful about what you yearn for, and they do it in a word. She walks out in the garden and she says to him, "Some farmer you turned out to be, Sean, no roses, no potatoes, and he says, no children. What people really care about, you know, well, I was in prison, he says to John Wayne and the Cowboys, Mr. Anderson, but you can forgive a guy that makes a mistake, can't you? He says, yeah, but I can't abide a liar. Mm-hmm. It's really down there where you live. You got to excavate for that. What do you really believe? That's why when all of these tawny-haired guys from San Anselmo say, I'm a filmmaker, that's why we have no film festival in Mill Valley. There are no pictures. Down where people live, you know, when I got to know Robin, beyond the hysteria on the stage, when I got to know him as a guy,
Robin Williams. Mm-hmm.
It was really rewarding. And she's a great girl. And she paints like crazy.
His wife?
Susan.
Oh, Susan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great painter. But if you don't get the girl, what the hell is good at going through the movie? That's the way I feel about life. And I had a third marriage, you know.
Let's talk about your third marriage.
I was coming back from a wake for my kid. He died at 22. He died at 19.
So you had a child with your second wife, Gina, right?
Yeah, Gina and I had a boy, and he died, and
he was born.
We had a
when?
Wake in Connecticut.
When was he born?
He was born in 76, Bastille Day.
And he died at how old?
At 19.
That's awfully young.
Yeah, and I went to the wake, and on a plane on the way back, I met a stewardess whom I didn't take out for 4 months, and then only at a distance. And we were married for 11 years.
May I ask you about your son? That must have been very difficult.
Yes, the toughest thing I ever went through. He was a great kid, but it's very dangerous to be a kid in America.
What was your son's name?
Mort Jr.
Mort Jr.
That was his mother's choice. Because, you know, the Jews don't have any juniors.
No, right. You don't name a child
no,
after a living.
Didn't. She didn't. He was half Chinese. And she was 9 siblings, you know, all had girls.
So here was the...
So he was the king down there in New Orleans, where she was from. And he was the guy I could finally talk to.
So your son, you were very close to.
Oh, yeah, the only kid. If I'd had my way, we would have had 10. I really liked it when I finally got to it.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when he was born, then?
I grew up a lot, and I really needed a sister to talk to. If I don't understand women, it's well-grounded. I never got to talk to one, and I was usually too broke to take any out. And I went from broke to a lot of money, but that doesn't guarantee anything.
So your son, Mort Jr., how did he feel about the work you did?
He was very proud of it, but he was into the music. He had a rock band, and he played the piano. In fact, his piano is up at Lucy's place. I brought it up here, up in the mezzanine. The work, he was ambivalent about the work. He loved Guns N' Roses. And he hung around wherever they were, and he finally met them. And he asked for an autograph. And he said, Mort, and Axl Rose said to him, is your dad Mort Song? He said, your father's a genius. And that night he treated me entirely differently.
Oh, what a moment is that.
I got endorsed by Axl Rose.
Far between.
I hate all that music. I hate all those guys up here with that phony bluegrass stuff. I'd rather hear a Dick play over at Marin Joe's on Wednesday night. You know, somebody who's grounded in it. I never liked the status quo. I don't like Wynton Marsalis. I never liked any of that stuff. I liked the writers who broke the barriers.
Do you think that your lifestyle affected your child? You know, the son of a famous man. I don't know the conditions in which your child died, but that's awfully young for a young man to pass.
Well, it may have. I think everything's moving too fast for kids now anyway. And he was one of them. He was defending me all the time. I used to hear him on talk shows on the radio. You know, and he was always the attorney for the defense. It was a combustible marriage. It was hard for him. He was the only kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when she left, you know, she started screaming, "I want the divorce." And I found out in that book that she filed 7 times.
Yes, I'm looking at this book, which is interesting to me that you had to read it to find out some of the things about your life. Last Man Standing, Mort Saul, and the Birth of Modern Comedy. I have to ask, when she was yelling she wanted a divorce, had you been living the lifestyle that I recall a time in this culture where men were quite liberal with the way they chose to be in a marriage? Fidelity may not be something that a man would be interested in, but a wife might be.
Well, I had a house in Beverly Hills. She decorated the whole thing and had permission to change it every year, including the paint. And if she decided she wanted to see Florence, Italy, we went that week. That doesn't mean that's everything, but we can afford to indulge a lot. When the Reagans had us to the White House, she could go have a designer make 2 dresses. One night she went into Beverly Hills and the furrier there had a sale. And she came back with 2 mink coats and she said to me, "It was such a bargain I couldn't turn it down." And she said, "You're a star and your wife should look good." And I said, "Maybe those coats will take their mind off the fact that my underwear is torn." I made a gag out of it, which is characteristic. I didn't care about the money. I didn't care about the money in the settlement or anything. The shattering fact that she would keep going to those Beverly Hills lawyers and want to get out. She wanted to go to the track every day.
Oh, I see. Okay, so back to your son and the time after his wake. And did this terrible calamity shake your optimism or your sense of romance or purpose in your life?
No, I still believe in a romance, and he was exactly like me, by the way. He was always in love. And he couldn't imagine us being in love, being his parents. And we really were at one time. So I went back to being a lifeguard and saving America and meeting girls along the way. That's when I met the stewardess.
Mm-hmm.
And she was pretty good, except she had a mother who discounted her, a southern mother in Atlanta, and a terrible kid, a dreadful kid.
Who so her 20, name is?
29 now and has never had a job.
Your third wife's name?
Yeah, Kensley.
Kensley?
Yeah.
Okay.
A terrible kid. Oh.
Tell us what you really think.
I mean, really, really dangerous. It looks like Lady Gaga, and it wasn't worth the trip. And then life took a turn on coming up here. I was teaching at Claremont. I was on the faculty.
And what were you teaching?
A course in assassination, screenwriting, and a course called The Revolutionary's Handbook. What do you do if you're a rebel and you got to support a family?
Oh, my gosh. I wouldn't have taken that class.
So I taught those three courses. And then I found that the whole place was full of Republicans who had to have a job. People like David Gergen and all. It was awful.
So you didn't think this going into Claremont College?
No, because I was recruited by a Jewish guy who loved David, not David Frost, Robert Frost. And then I got in there. And I found...
You're grabbing your neck, feeling a little strangled.
In the screenwriting course, they'd come in for notes, you know. A girl would come in for a meeting about her script, and they'd say, leave the door ajar if it's a female student.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So then a girl would come in, and every one of them was the same. They took... like Gloria Steinem in class, and then they write these love stories, which means they're still desiring. Say, he grabs her, he kisses her, she loves him. I said, why does she love him? I don't understand him. Why? Well, it's natural. I said, it's not dormitory sex. Why is it natural? How many times have you been in love? Really in love? And that caused a ruckus on the campus. Meanwhile,
Lucy Mercer hired
me to come into the Throgmorton, and it sold out in about an hour. And I come up here and filled it, and she brought me back the big theater. And
so Lucy must have been a fan.
Yeah, she liked it, and I went on the stage and had a big audience, and she brought me back, and then Kensley and I got divorced, and I was so disappointed in everything. I got out of L.A.
You got what?
I got out, and
got out of L.A.
I said to Lucy, oh, she met me in L.A. I had dinner with her there, and... I said, I'm going to get out here and start again. And she said, where are you going to go? I said, well, that depends. The house is sold, and that kid has destroyed my credit. And Lucy said, I own an apartment house.
She owns this apartment house?
So I took one blazer and one pair of gray pants and two blue shorts and got on a plane and came up here and just started ad-libbing it.
So this is what year?
10 and a half years ago.
So 10 and a half years ago, let's just summarize this. You've jumped again into a love affair. You've married someone. Not how long after your son's passing did you waited a while to date, but then you eventually did decide to marry, and then how long did you stay married for? Let me set that up for you.
To Kensley?
Uh-huh.
Oh, several years.
Several years. So
yeah, because the kid came when she was 9, and the kid was well into her 20s when I left.
Okay, so you've had a good long run with the third marriage.
Yeah.
So now, and you're getting older at this point.
Yeah. Inevitably.
And do you find it as easy to change your life utterly and begin anew when you're older as when you were younger?
No, because one thing, I got glaucoma.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a muscular problem with my spine. No, it's not easy.
So you're how old now?
When I came up here?
No, when you're no, right now.
Now I'm 91.
So you're in your early 80s.
Yeah, I'm 80.
With a blazer and a pair of pants.
Yeah.
Jumping into a new life with no real... Did you have friends?
No, here? I'm in the Mill Valley Inn.
You're at the Mill Valley Inn where Lucy's placed you. And so she found you, basically. She went to you to book you for your work. Knowing Lucy as I do, she has her antenna out far and wide, and she's quite involved in, I guess I would say, she sort of does a Vulcan mind melt with, she sees the world in a slightly different way. She has a sense of things, and she's quite intuitive. And so she senses Mort Saul and the importance of what you display and what you share, and brings you to Mill Valley. She might have even had a reason for that. So you come, you do well, quite well immediately, and then you just jump into this new life with what's on your back, basically.
Yeah, and I jump in here and... I've lost my driver's license, meanwhile, with Kensley.
Because you can't see?
Yeah, and I lost my driver's, so it means I've got no mobility out of here. But I still have the same beliefs.
Yeah.
So the act is still about Kennedy and the CIA in the theater. And I still like to get in the car and roll out and get a taco in the middle of the afternoon, but I can't. And I'm up here, and there's a certain kind of liberal shell here where all they talk about, if you go to a coffee house, is Trump anyway. They blame all their failings on Trump.
Well, which can't you were here before Trump became president, so 10 years ago.
Yeah, but they're materialistic.
So did that offend you, moving to Mill Valley and finding this world of...
No, I like Lucy and I like Greg.
Greg?
Who was here.
Your friend Greg, who was here
yeah,
when I arrived.
And I like them, but I don't like the city anymore.
You don't? What did you ever like Mill Valley?
I would never hear before. Mill Valley is where you came... After you were a financial success in the city, nobody was over here.
Oh,
everybody I knew when I lived in the city drove an MG and had two dogs in the back named Scotch and Soda. And
named what?
Scotch and Soda.
Uh huh.
You know, the manner thing with the English
Scotch
caps
and soda. Right?
And all that stuff, you know. I never came this way. I came from the East Bay to the city. But the city was the city then.
Yes.
I mean, today, who goes to Union Square? I used to go down there and shop and everything, and it changed now. I mean, there's drug dealers on every corner, and you can't arrest them because of Camilla Harris and the police chief. And the liberals are still pretending it's the old world. Last night, a girl who works at the theater says, my daughter just came out of Berkeley Law School. And what does she want? She wants to end capital punishment. Well, you know, I've watched Jerry Brown and Dianne Feinstein. I haven't seen any progress. I mean, that crowd is what's wrong with America. And they haven't had enough. They got to have Gavin Newsom, another man of accomplishment. The liberals have destroyed the country. And they're not liberals anyway. In Germany, they were called social democrats. They're usually Jews who didn't have the guts to be communists when they were in Berkeley. And they make up for it by talking about Martin Luther King all the time. And they shouldn't. They should talk about J. Edgar Hoover.
I'm sorry if I'm laughing. It's just you have
no,
a way
I'm
of
glad
saying.
You're laughing. That delights me. Because the whole thing over there in Berkeley where the Jewish girls were always curious sexually about the black guys. And the black guys, you notice, use that to their advantage. In that sense, they're like every male. They take feminine curiosity and use it to their advantage. And it leads to girls' disappointment all the time. They won't admit any of this. They're all noble. They won't salute the flag after they play basketball or before. And they're not noble. I mean, if you go over to the town center, you won't see a black guy behind the baby carriage.
So
listen to this.
Okay,
when my wife leaves, Gina.
Yes.
She leaves the kid with me.
Mm, your son.
Yeah, which is the worst thing you do. He's 14 years old. He's watching his mother walk out of the door. And I'm cooking. And a black lady I know volunteers to come over to help me. I want to take care of Moore Jr. and the house and everything. The black lady turns out to be married to a highway patrolman. And he's got a girl and a son. And he has a baby with the girl and the son. Then he has two. Then he has three. So Lou, is the name of the lady, goes over and sees that the girlfriend drinks and the girls are starting to drink. So she takes all three over with her and starts raising them as her daughters, which will give you an idea of her character. And what did every one of them do? Go out with a black athlete and have a kid who with a guy that won't marry them. So history repeats itself. And then Lou saved up her money and opened up a soul food place with yams and ribs and everything. And she said to me, everybody is eligible to work here except black guys because you got to watch them like a cop. Interesting.
Including her husband, who is the black guy. Who's
the highway patrolman. And, you know, I've never used that on a stage. I've never told anybody that before. But if you did it, everybody would call you a bigot up here. But the question is, what category is the truth under? What is it about?
Okay, so you're here in Mill Valley. We don't have the MGs with two dogs named Scotch and Soda in the back and a cap on.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. But we are in Mill Valley. This is where you live. You have this lovely apartment. Lucy's been, if nothing else, the best friend and a true fan to
that's
you.
True.
I mean, you talk about love. And it's more than words, it's actions. I mean, there is a woman in your world that is definitely, in her actions in all ways, is demonstrating love. And this is where you live. Tell me about Mill Valley. Be the lifeguard in our town.
Well, it's fraudulent. It's broken in two parts. There's the downtown crowd, and then there's Tam Junction. And nobody can come over and give you a massage. They have to talk about tension and palm leaves and yoga. Nobody will tell you where they bleed from the heart. Not willingly. The idea of the theater is
the Throckmorton Theater.
Lucy's refusing to compromise. I know those guys in the city council would like to make condos out of it. You know that tiger she's got on the side of the building?
Yeah.
She went to the city council meeting, and the guy said, we want that tiger off. And she said, this is the home of Maria Mulder and Dan Hicks and Robert Williams.
And
Bonnie Raitt. Mm-hmm. And she says, an artist's home. And the guy said, well, if you want to cooperate as a city councilman, I'm stating that must come off. And she said, that status could always change. And that's a lot for her. Mm-hmm. because even when she knew this book was going south, all she did was stop ordering and some people would come
in. The book, out. The Last Man Standing,
yeah,
didn't do so well.
Wouldn't come in and get it autographed by me after the show. She didn't make a lot of noise about it, but that's all she did. That's because she doesn't think it caught what it was about, because it collided with the author's view of America. The author is one of those guys that thinks Obama was noble.
James Curtis, right.
You know, a black man at a distance who can be ennobled. But they never would have made friends with Duke Ellington either. And he was the best. And he wasn't interested in being held up as the best, which might be the ticket to it all. But anyway.
Back to Lucy.
Yeah, Lucy's an individual, but she's a fighter. She would never let anybody change her. Not through psychoanalysis, not through marriage. Those girls are lucky to have her.
You
know,
mean her daughters? Her daughters?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, Gabby would never have anybody else understand her the way her mother does. That she'll go to New Zealand because she gets a rise out of that guy. Or anywhere else she has to go to feel like a woman. They talk about women. They don't know anything about women. They're afraid of women.
Who's afraid of women?
The liberals are all afraid of women. And, you know, I knew the queens of the movement. You know, I knew Betty Friedan. I know Steinem real well. And they're not worthy representatives of women.
Who is?
A woman who has the courage to go her own way, whether it's love or microbiology at Stanford. You know, I know a girl here who was working at the Pilates store, and she got a biology degree from Stanford. And her parents are materialistic Jewish people, which is always a mistake. And she loved Billie Holiday. So you know where she is now? In Nashville. She went there and took it the way it was and loves it.
You are a dreamer.
And there are the other people here. You know Chris Britt, who hangs around the theater and knows me, and
I don't.
He
think
works
so.
For Dell with Snapchat and all that stuff, so he has free time to go to Hawaii and meet Ram Dass, and go up and talk to Lucy and come over here and talk to me and talk to Greg. It's a unique place in that way, but the percentage of people that are like that, there aren't enough.
Where have you ever lived where there are enough? I mean, don't you find it's kind of like mining for gold? If you have a vision or you're looking, let's say your
great
music,
question.
I mean, your music, let's say you're part of a jazz band and you're always looking for that complementary sound that's unique in its own right, yet somehow there's synergy with you. That's not always so easy to find, is it?
No, the movies ruined my thinking.
You've been brainwashed.
Yeah, by a bunch of Russian Jewish guys that made those movies and were later blacklisted. For instance, you know, Harry Cohen, you remember him in Columbia?
Oh, I love those old films.
A real fascist, you
yeah.
know.
I mean,
David Beagleman walks in with Redford and he says to Harry, "Look at that punim. Have you ever seen a face like that?" And Harry Cohen went to the window. He said, "I can throw a rock out this window and hit 15 guys that look like that." He wouldn't accept it. I mean, why were they that good? Why did Zanuck know that Gregory Peck wasn't just anybody? Why could Jimmy Stewart, who, by the way, was a fascist, how could he how could they make those movies?
It's the passion, you think.
Wayne, you certainly know Wayne's politics. Yeah. But he's a humanist in his movies.
Yeah, I think that's the word, the humanist, which is a word that's often used with
drama
people.
It crosses over, and that's why we run to it, because you can't wrap your arms around your virtue at night. I sure know that. Mm-hmm. Personally, you know, to drive women away from romance, Steinem, 24 carat opportunist to work for the CIA all her life. When she got married, the guy was a Republican and an arms dealer, whom she deserted when he had cancer. And I kept running into her because my best friend was Herb Sargent, the writer. And she had a big affair with him. And, as big as she can have. I don't think she could love the way my mother did. You know, in spite of coming from money and going to none and realizing that people don't get bad, they just get old. She knew it.
Your mother sounds very interesting.
Oh, she was something else. I owe her all the optimism, and she always knew it would get better. And when I finally broke through in Hollywood, you know, I brought them down, and I got them a house in Westwood near UCLA. But when I took her out to the studio and she met Paul Newman and Sinatra and Glenn Ford, and she was really in her element. She loved it.
So when you're here in Mill Valley, and this is your home now.
Yeah.
It's likely to be your home, I think, for the rest of your life, wouldn't you say?
Pardon me?
It's likely to be your home for the rest of your life, would you say? Do you think you have it in you to start again anywhere else?
I wouldn't know where to go, because the last time I went to New York, and listen, I went back, I did the Carlisle, mm-hmm. where Woody plays. And we both had lunch with Woody and Cabot. And although I love him, Woody especially has been generous to me, they're kind of dead. I mean, Woody married that chick.
His stepdaughter, or his, stepdaughter.
And Cabot never had any fight in him. I helped him get in a hungry eye because he's my friend. But he never, and that's what he wanted. That's enough for me. You know, the great Lenny Bruce, if he met a comedian and he got him a job, and the guy got $200, he'd take a $20 commission. The thing about Lenny Bruce is he wasn't profound as a Jew. He couldn't see through walls the way Jewish people used to. That's all a lie. You know, I was the technical advisor on the movie with Dustin. Mm-hmm. And he made him into it like Jesus. He wasn't. He was a guy. I was the lovable part of him. Mm-hmm. And then Dustin topped it off by coming to the Mill Valley Film Festival and going down to Fonteca. Remember? Was that the name of it? Fonteca?
Fontoya.
And he comes in after the show and walks right by me. I wrote a lot of Tootsie for Sidney Pollack. He walks right by me. And I finally went over and talked to him, and he treated me like a stranger. And he's not a star. That's why he was never a star. Just because of that. Steve McQueen was a star.
So, let me ask you a couple things about Mill Valley a little bit more, because I appreciate your vision and your critique of what this town is like for you. You've lived in a lot of places, correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You've lived in a lot of places, and this is where you live now in Mill Valley, which has its own particular you know, we have proximity to the mountain, Mount Tamalpais. We have proximity to San Francisco. All the basics that do make a very interesting, the possibility for many things to happen here, both through nature, through culture, and it's liberal, or as you would say, I guess, pseudo-liberal. How would you yourself, as a visionary, see things differently to make this, you know, you with your X-ray vision, how could things, it's one thing to make a comment about the status quo, but you are a lifeguard to save it. Save this town. Tell me what it needs.
Well, everybody whose ear I've got, I tell the truth. I think enough of them that I do on a show and I do on a personal basis when I'm down at Coyote. You know.
Coyote?
Yeah, at Greg's place.
Uh-huh.
If a girl, a masseur down there, says to me, how are you? I say, she says, I'd be a lot better without Trump. So I do feel an obligation personally to tell her, as a woman, her life can't be ruined by Trump. That's the coinage. That's the coin of the realm here. And most liberal communities. I'm sure it is in L.A. too. If you pick up Twitter, all you read are men complaining about Trump, and very feminized men, interestingly enough.
So if, let's say people are lost, Mort. People are lost.
Yeah, very good.
Okay? People are lost, and they're doing their best, but they're lost. It's a confusing world. There's all kinds of strange things happening, incongruencies. Our souls are starved in some ways. The culture, consumerism, these things have altered our perceptions and our ability to see truth. What's the lifeline? This is your town. You speak truth. Truth is, to you, is that when you have your tools to resuscitate as a lifeguard, what's in your toolbox? Simply because
you tell them the truth and see if anything you got appeals to them. Like a salesman with a case full of your stuff, the Fuller Brush Man. By the way, do you remember Senator Sam Ervin?
No.
Well, it's before they had all these mediocre people in Congress. Sam Ervin says during Watergate to John Mitchell, you were the Attorney General, and you lied under oath. What do you have to say to that? And Mitchell said, I wouldn't do it again. And Ervin said, I'm from North Carolina, and there was a traveling salesman that came down there one day, and he met a farmer's daughter, and she discovered she was in a family way, and there was a knock on his door at the hotel, and he was looking down the barrels of a shotgun from the farmer's daughter,
the father.
Mm-hmm. And he said, the salesman said, I'm sorry, but I wouldn't do the same thing again. And the farmer said, you mean you're coming back to town? See, they had a fiber in them. And I suppose what I admire about the Jews is I'm looking for the fiber. So I am prejudiced in that sense. They're not putting up a fight. They did in Russia. That's what killed Hitler. The general that defended Stalingrad and turned the war around was a Jew. There's something. And look at them in Congress. Look how soft they are. I realize it's romantic and it's a far cry from realism. But you're always looking. If you're a man, you should be looking. You're not looking for failure to reinforce you. You're hoping that there's somebody who will appreciate the line. the guy that puts out Marin Magazine, you know, mm-hmm. he interviewed me. Mm-hmm. He said, well, all the money you made, you must be a very happy camper. What a genius. Mm-hmm. With all the money I've made, I was flying for nothing on Air Force One and having arguments with Kennedy, which he thought were foolhardy, but I was there when he argued with his wife. And who, you know, was really something. Last time I ran into her, I went into
Jackie Onassis?
Pardon me?
You're talking about Jackie Onassis?
Jackie, yeah. Mm-hmm. I went into an art gallery, 73rd Madison. Mm-hmm. And that's after I'd been on the air with Garrison. And I walked up to her and she said, I know. You bet she knows.
Yes.
The first party they had after he got sworn in, she wanted Sonny and Cher there. And he wanted Pablo Casals. And when he won, and when he introduced Casals, he said, there hasn't been this much culture in the East Room since Jefferson dined alone. Think about it. I mean, you know, and I always thought of him, he was only 10 years older than me, and I always thought of him as like a stand-in for Stevenson, who was a heartbreak guy, you know, had a terrible marriage, and his wife hated him 20 years later with all that hatred that only a disappointed woman can summon. It must have been awful. Good kids, by the way.
Okay, so what scares you more right now at this point in your life? Anything?
What's what?
What scares you? What frightens you?
Oh, that I'm going to be alone the rest of my life.
That you're going to be alone the rest of
your
life.
Yeah, that scares me.
When you're talking about the fiber, you know, when that man said to you, you're a happy camper, meaning you've had financial success, and I'm watching your eyes roll as you say this because that's not what it is for you. But when you're talking about the fiber for you, and I've listened to you speak now for probably close to 2 hours, and I hear your passion, I hear you have a horizon, it seems to me, that you see, maybe you alone can see, that guides you.
Well, if somebody like Kaiser, who's already talked to us, sponsors the show and publicizes it, and millions hear it, that would reinforce me a lot.
Okay, so we haven't spoken about this in the interview, but in the pre-interview we talked a little. You said that you're now live streaming your show.
I'm not like...
Live streaming, is that what you were saying on what's going on? Let's talk, as we're getting closer to the end of the interview, let's discuss what it is in your work that's happening, that's poignant right now at the Throckmorton on Thursdays, correct?
Yeah, when I can put something out there and they really grasp it.
They being?
The audience.
The audience.
Really grasp it. Or when you dumbfound them. Like somebody called last night and they say, what was going on with Marilyn Monroe and Jack Kennedy? I said, why do you assume it was Jack Kennedy? And
they're... dot, dot, dot.
And those are great. Those are great moments. And when I can really grab their attention with something that's truthful, I remind them, I said, you remember when Trump was elected and you were all sitting Shiva down here at the depot? What's happened to you since then? You're not in prison camps or what? What's the apprehension? What's it? what's it really about? And of course, there's certain things don't change. There's the mystery of women. I don't really understand Lucy. I'm eternally fascinated by her, but I don't understand her. I don't know why she isn't like all the others. She's not predictable. And we turn to all that other stuff, writing and everything, and framing the jokes in an effort to startle the audience. All the guys I admired in the movies could startle the audience. I saw Casablanca 2 nights ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew the guys who wrote that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how they knew that would grab an audience. It's all so unlikely. And once in a while I try movies in the act. Did you ever see a movie called The Professionals?
Mm-hmm.
It's Burt Lancaster and Lee Marvin.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, they startle the kidnapper. He sends them to retrieve his wife, and she's in love with her captor. And they frustrate him in pursuing him. And he says, "You bastard." And Lee Marvin says, "Yes, sir. In my case, an accident of birth. But you, sir, you're a self-made man." Those crystallized moments, you know. And not just guys, by the way. It comes along with certain people. Jane Mayer at The New Yorker. Susie Weitzman at Pacifica. Perceives. Because she's not afraid to join the human race. That's the stuff that makes you optimistic. The rest, of course, is social hypocrisy, which is good for me on the stage. I can always hold it up to the hard light of day. And notice, I started in 54. There's nobody doing it. They're running the other way. Keep talking about robotic cars and all that.
Do you describe yourself as a humanist?
I never have. I never thought about that.
Is it occurring to you that you might be, even with all the inherent contradictions, that you are basically a humanist?
Well, it would be funny. I mean, you're really inquisitive. And the last time I sat down with somebody, it was a guy, and he wasn't inquisitive. He was busy defending the status quo. That's not lost on me. You know,
maybe we're both
because
searchers.
They're talking about equality and everything. I don't think Tina Fey is a good writer. And it isn't because I'm anti-feminine. She doesn't grasp the absurdity of, as Al Sargent says, love and pain and the whole damn thing. I don't know that I do, but I want to, at least. I want to know what went wrong with those girls and me and why they don't forgive. If Trina had the capacity to forgive, that kid would still be alone.
Mm-hmm. So it's time for us to sort of close up, but would you mind if I make a couple of observations?
Sure.
First of all, I want to tell you how very interesting it's been for me to talk with you. Very interesting for me to talk with you. And I appreciate your insights and your candor. And I can't help but see that you are a bit of a searcher. Maybe even you're going to find death by astonishment at the end of your journey. which is actually, isn't that truly something that we can hope
for? I'm always surprised by, I mean, I'm not prepared for the surprises. On my birthday, you know, I got taken out to the Two Birds.
To the where?
The Two Birds. You know, Two Birds in Woodacre.
Oh, no, you told me about that on the phone, this the cafe, Two Birds,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and the girl was with me. Mm-hmm. She's 23. She's studying nursing at Marin College and works at Balboa three nights a week. But she surprises me with her perception. Not when you meet her mother. Very good mother. Even ground. And the others get hard because the men disappoint them, I think. I don't know how hard any of my alumni are because none of them see me. You know, I called her in Antioch.
Called who?
Sue.
Mm-hmm.
When I got up here, I said, I'm back.
Mm-hmm. Your first wife.
Yeah, I said, how would you like to have lunch? I don't think that would be a good idea at all. So she's over there with a guy she'd been with 40 years, who never married her, and has my name. But she was brutal on the phone, like she'd been saving it up. Gina won't even answer me. The birthdays, anything that meant anything to her. And Kensley is with a guy who's been paying the bills for 10 years and is still married. Why would a woman let a guy get away with that? They're really awful, you know, if they're not policed, guys. By conscience or income, they really are awful. I mean, aren't they? And they won a medal for working in San Jose. I mean,
Mark, I think.
What is the matter with guys? I never have asked anybody this before. I'm usually probably afraid of the answer.
Do you know, I'm going to give you an answer. I'm going to step outside of the bounds of interview and I'm going to give you an answer. When I was studying science as an adult, I asked my professor how frustrated I was to I felt like I was on my knees looking through a keyhole into a vast room filled with everything I wanted to know, but I could only see as much as that keyhole. And I was so frustrated. And he said, in order to be comfortable studying science, you must learn to love the mystery.
What's the last part?
You must learn to love the mystery.
Oh. Well,
I can only say that in trying to understand so much, as I see you ponder and search like a cell phone looking roaming for that connection, that the mystery abounds and satisfaction and understanding isn't a given. But we might learn to love the mystery. I don't know. I have no answer for your question. I don't know. But that you're still wondering about that, that your heart is even broken while you're describing these things and you're perplexed and you search for meaning around you, is the best description I can think of to describe the individual I'm meeting today.
Well, then you'll be interested in this. I never told anybody this, but the conversation's been so good. I wrote a movie for Robin before he got sick.
Robin Williams.
Yeah. And it was about a guy who is invested in what I'm invested in.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally sues the studios for giving him unreal expectations of romance, and he wins. And they take the case because they want to publicize their movies. And he's losing, but everybody's watching because it's about love. Everybody's watching the trial. And a guy like Jerry Weintraub gets up representing Motion Picture Association, and he says, "Who is this guy to put down $3 and expect all his problems to be solved? It's only a movie. He's wrong. He's crazy. He's delusional." And his wife stands up in the back of the courtroom and says, "You used to be like that. That's why I loved you." And he wins. So, hey, I wrote that for Robin. I paid off Kelsley's alimony with that. And, of course, we couldn't get it made because they thought he can only play a maniac.
Oh, he was a very dear man. I'm sorry that that's the case.
Hell of a guy I found up close. Oh, man.
You know, Mort, I'd like to read that screenplay someday.
Pardon?
I'd like to read that screenplay someday.
Oh, yeah, easy. If I can find it around here at the... Chris typed it up. I just walked up and down and dictated it. And he tried to get it made. He couldn't get it made.
Of course.
And,
well...
One last blow for romance, you know.
But one rah-rah for hope. And you're hanging on to it till the end, I think. The belief...
Well, it's the same with the act. You know, the act is not all stuff that people can easily process. Mm-hmm. I even do part of the Garrison trial in the act, and that's a hard thing to focus on. But we did it. We went to court. I wrote the summation to the jury, and but I thought they ought to walk away with what happened to America and whether they won't participate in it. That's what I want the show to accomplish, because they have the mistaken notion that only Trump participates in it.
Yes.
God knows. I don't know him. I used to know them pretty well. But he's had one secretary for 38 years. It must be some human part of him.
I don't know. I think that I'm going to have to come see your show, though. I hope that
you're more than welcome. You're pretty smart, Deborah.
Well, it all depends on the interviewee. Mort, I'm going to close this interview finally. I hate to do so because you're an interesting man.
Yeah.
And I appreciate your passion. I appreciate your courage as well. You've stood up on stage, and you've challenged yourself and others. You've made a life of that, and for that I thank you. You're an example for many of us to keep up the good fight in that regard, because it's not always easy to stay with truth. It hurts. It takes a lot of courage to see the world as it is, not as you want it to be. So I admire your efforts and your horizon. I thank you for living in our town, however the fates brought you here. And I hope to have another opportunity to sit and talk, chat with you someday as friends.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Is there any one thing you can say or a moment that you can share upon closing, a moment in your life that you can end this interview with, an experience, something that we can close with?
Well, Uh, It's kind of provincial, you know, but I should tell you that at the beginning. But, you know, when a guy like Franken stands up and says, Assange and the Russians defeated Hillary and
A guy like who?
Assange. And Hillary betrayed Hillary, and or Adam Schiff. And I keep thinking to myself, how can a Jewish guy do that?
Yeah.
I'm still that provincial. You know, and for so little, you know, whereas I'm remembering Paul Wellstone.
Paul who?
Wellstone. He was up there in Minnesota, and McCarthy was a very close friend of mine. And he always looked for, he understood all shorthand, you know. Last night somebody said to me, what about the black football players not rising for the national anthem? And I was tempted to say to him, let's talk about something meaningful. And I said, just because you're paid to betray Jesus and you don't cash the check doesn't make you a Christian. And I let him wrestle with that for a while. You know, I'm not very religious, but I believe that because it's credible to me that the guy brought out everybody's cruelty because he was looking for their virtue.
Jesus, you mean?
And he could only rely on his mother, which is really amazing, but not amazing. I don't know why, but the undercurrent to this whole conversation that people are living with people they don't love, and it's so hard even when you love them. Mm-hmm. How do they sustain all that? I'm not a good enough writer to write it. I wouldn't accept an assignment like that. But all the old guys, you know, when I started, I needed to write because they wouldn't let me work as a performer after the Garrison thing. So I didn't know how to write. So I went to all the writers I knew in Hollywood, and they were amazing, you know. Jack Newman, who's a very good writer, he said to me, you know, there's a kind of a gloom hanging over this. You're depressed, aren't you? I said, yeah, my friends let me down. He said, okay, think of yourself at a bar and you're ready to drink till you fall down because you're depressed. I said, okay. He said, and then at the end of the bar, you notice that a beautiful girl has walked in. How do you feel now? They were great that way. You know, they knew just what to say, you know. Guy says to John Wayne, he says, you worked around here? He says, no, we worked every spread. You name them. And Wayne says, no, you name them. And he said, well, I got to confess to you, we're in prison, but you would give a man another chance, wouldn't you, Mr. Anderson? And Wayne says, yeah, but I can't abide a liar. They knew all of that, and I don't know how they knew it. Did you ever see that movie, The Cowboys?
No.
He's broke, you know. He's a lower middle class. He's got to drive the herd out, and he's older. So he takes kids out of the junior high and lets them drive the herd. And the kids go into the water and one of them almost drowns. Mm-hmm. And Wayne says, you might as well get used to it. And he pushes them into the water. And the kid mumbles, "Son of a bitch." He said, "What did you say?" And he says it again. He says, "Louder." So the kid yells it. "You're a mean, crusty old son of a bitch." And Wayne says, "Good. I wouldn't make a habit out of saying that, though." There's not much of him left. But I don't know why they knew that. Why they knew how far they could push you. And
sometimes, you know,
made Humphrey Bogart a leading man and he wins Ingrid Bergman.
You know, Mort, sometimes you just have to appreciate the mystery. I think we can close with that, don't you think?
The movies were all we could afford when I was a kid.
Yeah.
It was a dime.
Yeah.
And when I really made money, I didn't find that much more understanding proportionately.
Well.
And when I left Beverly Hills, Persians came to buy the house. A gay Persian couple. I suppose that people up here are too tolerant, but it may be a national condition.
It may be a national condition right now. I don't know. At any case, we're going to have to close this interview. But I'll be back to talk life with you. I have the same curiosities. I'm as baffled as you, so let's continue this off the record, shall we?
Okay.
Mort, thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, it was great to meet you.
And to share your amazing life, I've got to say. I will see you at the Throckmorton.
Good. That would be great.
And perhaps some of our listeners will see you there, too. And keep it up, man. Keep it up, pal.
How was Steve when you interviewed him?
Here, we'll end our interview, shall we? Okay.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yes, let's end. Okay, thanks so much, Mort.
Well, you're welcome.
This would conclude your interview.